I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere, a holistic exploration of individual health, community, and culture. The topics we'll be discussing on this show will address health for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight. Welcome to the show. Kevin and Sam here. And you got to listen to the theme music to our show that's done by David Leckenby.
And you got to hear it twice.
we really love his music. And if you want to check out more of his music, you can go to davidleckenby.com. He's got a new track up there that he's been working on. So today we have Ali Barker in our studio, and we're so excited to have you on the show. Ali is a master at sustainable growing, root cellars. She owns and operates the Chugach Farm with her partner, Jed Workman. And they have done everything off the grid. And their produce, they sell at the Saturday markets. They do shares. Phenomenal. Just incredible produce. So we're excited to have you on the show. And Sam, you want to just do a little bit of
I'm just going to read a little intro on Ali. And if you go to our Facebook page, you can also read it. It's up there along with some of the resources that Ali provided us with. So Ali Barker grew up observing the Amish's ability to live and grow food sustainably. From her original roots in rural Ohio to farming and communal living in Washington to traveling the wild mountains of Alaska, Ali has fostered a stewardship and a reverence for the natural world. Laying down roots in Chickaloon in 2002, Ali consciously chose to live off the grid, grow her own food, harvest and wildcraft medicine, and mill local wood. She made a deliberate choice to have more time than money. She enjoys growing beets the size of her head and prides herself on not having bought a vegetable in over 8 years. She shares an enthusiasm for growing food and living the modern-day homestead in an age of ever-increasing unpredictability. She strives towards resiliency and sustainability and seeks out energy-saving solutions to modern-day consumption. Ali, her husband Jed, and her dog Dylan run Chugach Farm in Chickaloon, where they grow organic vegetables and herbs. They provide a small CSA, sell at the Spinard Farmers Market, and also sell to restaurants. Ali was an Alaska Agriculture Innovative Grant recipient and just finished building a permanent Earthship-style greenhouse with wood heat that will significantly extend the season for vegetable production. Ali also advises and teaches workshops on root cellar design, herbal medicine, raising backyard chickens, fermenting food, eating gluten-free, and more. So we're going to try to talk about all that stuff in 1 hour, see how much we can get to. But what we first want to get to, besides what we just learned about you from that bio, is just to get a little bit more of a background, like where you started. And we also want to – Ali brought in three carrots for us from her garden, so we're going to do a little carrot crunching for you. You hear that? Mm-hmm. That's last year's carrots.
This is last year's carrots.
And it's still pretty crunchy.
Uh-huh.
That's from your root cellar, right?
Uh-huh.
Crunch, crunch, crunch. You're probably not supposed to do that on the radio, but we're doing it anyway.
Well, when I first came to Alaska in 1998, it was actually to do a ski mountaineering trip in the mountains, and just kind of fell in love with this place. And I actually remember when I first went into the grocery store and was looking at some of the produce in there, and I just kind of these numbers were clicking in my head. I was thinking about how fresh the stuff was, or lack of freshness, really, and where it came from, and the price of the produce, and the inputs, the cost to get it here. And I just decided at that point in time that I needed to go grow all my own food, and I didn't buy anything, and I walked out, and that was pretty much the end of that. I'd say that since then I've really tried to make an effort to, you know, grow what I can, and honestly it's turned into an obsession a little bit, and evolved into multifaceted kind of homestead-esque lifestyle of doing what we can to this day and age for ourselves.
So Ali's done workshops on how to make your own root cellar. And so we thought we could talk a little bit about that and then maybe go into a little bit about how the CSA is run and you know, how you coordinate that to feed. How many families are you feeding this year, you think, with the CSA?
This year we're feeding 5 families plus our own and then interns that are at the farm and people who kind of some locals and friends who come by and help out, say, a day a week and making sure that we have enough food for all of them. And, you know, everything that we grow is on less than an acre. So probably half an acre, you know, pretty darn small. We'd really like to be able to provide more CSA shares for people in the future. But at this point, yeah, we're growing on a pretty small space.
Mm-hmm. So you have to really do what you can to make the most out of what it is that you grow and how to and preserve it and save it in the root cellar, right? So that you have food to last you for the whole year.
Yeah. Yeah. So the root cellar really is integral to everything that we're doing. The root cellar is, of all the structures we've built, the root cellar is the most important one. And it, you know, the first cellar, actually, it was funny because the first year we were growing food, well, at that point, the cabin was sitting on cinder blocks, and I was digging a root cellar next to the cabin, and I didn't really have any idea what I was doing. I just knew that we were growing food, and I needed a hole in the ground, and I needed somewhere to put it.
This was year, what year was this?
This was 2003.
Okay.
And so I dug a hole straight down and then kind of, like, you know, and then we jacked up the cabin and we rolled it on top of the hole. And that was our root cellar. And we had a hole that went down about 8 feet. And it was kind of like a little tunnel. And we lined it with a piece of old roofing tin. And I remember we used to Rochambeau for who was going to go down in there because it was really hard to get in there. Like, you know, all these climbing moves, you know, you're down in the bottom trying to lift these baskets out, everything stacked on top of each other. And for some reason, I was the one who always had to go down the hole. But
spelunking for dinner.
Yeah, for carrots, right. And it worked well for a while. We decided, okay, let's research this and figure out how to do this right. And that actually, that original root cellar is our fridge now. So there's a little trap door in the floor, and that's where that is.
Yeah, I've been to Allie's house, and that's her fridge. It's a hole in the ground. That's awesome.
And it works really well, you know, pretty much year round. It's great. So the new root cellar, you know, I think that the most important things to kind of convey about root cellars are. A lot of people are just not sure how to do it, and they know that they want one, and they're really hesitant to build one. And I say just go for it and figure something out. Dig a hole in the ground, make one in your neighbor's yard, retrofit a basement, a crawl space. There are a lot of people in the community who have really been creative in figuring out how to preserve food. And, I mean, the most important things that you need to do to store your food properly are you need the proper temperature. So 32 is ideal. You know, a lot of people's actually state like 38, 35, 38. That's mm-hmm. okay. Humidity, this is the one thing that everyone gets a little confused about. You actually want really high, like 80% to 90% humidity. So we have an earth floor in ours, and it just breathes. You know, the earth does all the work. Doesn't require any energy at all. So as long as you have high humidity, your vegetables will stay fresh. And then ventilation. We have a high vent that's flush with the ceiling in one corner, and then a vent that comes down almost to the floor in the other corner, so that air can circulate. And then if you store your vegetables properly, either layering them in sawdust or sand, whatever you have around, and, you know, in baskets that are aerated, and you're growing varieties that are good storage varieties.
And you have a two-stage root cellar, right? You've got it's colder in the back and a little bit warmer in the front. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. The idea with our root cellar, we actually build it mostly from the book Root Cellaring by Mike and Nancy Buble that's at the Sutton Library. And we went with a design where we have a double chamber. So the front room helps insulate the back room. The root cellar itself is north-facing. It's super insulated. But because we do have some some seriously cold temperatures in the winter sometimes. The front room does not have the ventilation the back room does. So the front room stays about 50-60% humidity, which is actually perfect for canned goods, onions, garlic, squash, the things that don't like the 80-90% humidity in the back room that the cabbage, carrots, beets, turnips, rutabagas, all of that stuff loves. The other thing, I think the most important thing about root cellars is that it doesn't require any inputs, no power, no electricity, nothing. You know, the first few years before we had really finished putting all the earth on top, we had a couple winters where it dropped pretty cold and we were wondering, is it going to go below freezing in there? And we lit a candle and that raised the temperature 1 or 2 degrees. And that was like our, you know, if something happens, light the candle. And it worked out great.
It's so simple.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I mean, some people have like a light bulb in there, but, you know, that wasn't really possible for us. Mm-hmm. So.
And you built the root cellar for about, what, a couple $1,000? Was that?
Yeah, we built ours for $2,000. And let's see, the front room is about 3x5. The back room is 8x10. And that was doing all the labor ourselves. And we have a friend who built one for probably $1,200-$1,500. So you can, similar to ours, a little smaller. So you could do it cheaper. But that's your kind of your one-time, you know, investment. And then you've got this amazing space.
And has that been enough space in general for everything that you want to store in there? Or do you find that you still run out of space in the root cellar?
We are maxed out, but it works for us right now. And I think if we were to start doing a root CSA where we supplied root vegetables year-round to the community, we would need to build another root cellar. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, it works for us. And it's funny because building it, we thought, oh my gosh, this is crazy. We don't need to build it this big. But we use every inch of it.
So I heard about somebody in, I think, is it maybe Bethel, who's like sunk a whole bunch of, are they shipping containers?
Yeah, like Connex.
Yeah, Connex containers in the ground, and he's doing like some sort of a root vegetable CSA, and that's what he's
Tim Myers, Farm. Yeah, he's a good friend of mine out in Bethel. He buried 4 Connexes, and he's got hundreds of thousands of pounds of root vegetables stored in there just with a dirt floor, and they're doing great, and he's storing those and supplying them to locals year-round. And, I mean, he's even sent stuff over, you know, to Natural Pantry and over to Anchorage to be selling cabbages in the winter.
Great. Now, yours is actually built into a hillside. Is that?
It is. Yeah, it's a north-facing hill, and we scooped. We actually used a machine, and we scooped a hole out of the hill, and then because I dug the first one by hand, it was like, oh. Yep, could use a little bit of work, a little bit of help with this one. Scooped a hole out, and then Jed and I poured a concrete footer and then built a block wall. And we didn't fill the block wall with concrete. Actually, the corners we did. The rest of the cells had some gravel. And then we milled a bunch of wood and basically framed it up to be able to support pouring a 4-inch thick roof. And then we put about 6 inches of foam on the roof, a piece of visqueen, and then threw the earth back over it, and that's it.
So it's basically a sod roof? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, yep. Okay, so it's growing. The top of the roof is growing.
Oh, yeah,
grass
there's,
and stuff. Yeah.
There's red clover we harvest for tea on top.
On top of the root cellar.
Nettles and, a bunch of stuff growing up there. Buckwheat.
Wow. You're growing buckwheat on top of the root cellar. Uh-huh. That's great.
You know, in that front chamber, I'm having a hard time figuring out how that, in the very cold winters that we have, it's, you know, 20 or 30 degrees below zero at times. And I'm wondering, how is that first chamber kept from getting really, really freezing?
It's super insulated. So on the inside of that front chamber, we actually have 3-inch blue board and the whole and the whole inside of it. And then the sides on the outside of that front room are have earth kind of pushed up against it. So it is colder than the back room, but this winter it didn't freeze in the front room. So
And you have with you a new book that someone just wrote on root cellaring?
Julia Fryer just wrote a new book called The Complete Guide to Your New Root Cellar, How to Build an Underground Root Cellar and Use it for Natural Storage of Fruits and Vegetables.
And she actually interviewed Jed and Allie about their root cellar. And there's a great story in there that I'll let Allie tell you about why she now has a latch on both sides of the inner door of the root cellar.
I was actually friend stopped by one day, and they wanted to see the root cellar, and, you know, it was middle summer, and we went in there, and Jed happened to be brewing beer that day and was kind of in his chemistry zone of thinking about other things and beer equations or whatever brewers do. And so I was in the root cellar with a friend, and Jed came in frantically looking for hops or something, and then walked out and closed the latch, and I realized we were locked in there.
This is the inner one, the inner part of the root cellar?
The back room. And I realized that I, of course, had turned the bluegrass music on. Everyone knows I'm a total bluegrass addict, and had the bluegrass playing really loud outside. So he couldn't hear us at all, and we're in there, and I'm just going around talking about every different jar that we have, and they're like, this is how we made cranberry ketchup.
And they did not know they were locked in?
They did, but trying to ease, you know, get a little more relaxing. And, yeah, we're yelling out through the vent pipes. And we were in there probably an hour, and eventually, in between, you know, bluegrass tunes,
You heard some.
And Jack comes out, and he's like, oh, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, what am I doing? Lock me in the root cellar.
So now you have an ability to open it from both sides.
Yeah, actually you have putting a bell, right, on the top, and then only a string that runs down through the vent. So you get locked in there. You can ding, 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 ding. Hey, I'm in here.
Great. That's good.
Yeah. And so the whole thing is off the grid. Is that right?
Yes. It is. You mean everything that we're doing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're always trying to improve upon what we're doing and make it more efficient and use less resources and more sustainable and try to create a more resilient kind of system. And I mean, I think it's ever evolving and really, you know, I don't think you ever totally figure it out. You're always working on it, but we're off the grid, and we just have solar, and at this point we're working on making our wind turbine contribute to our power for the winter, and we have a solar well pump that we will let the battery bank charge up from the solar panels during the day and then turn it on at night to fill our water storage on top of a hill, and then everything for our farm is gravity fed on timers from that. So that works
So let me just say that back to you, because that's really ingenious. So during the day, the solar power is charging up the battery, and then at night the thing runs and pumps the water into containers that you have sitting on top of a hill. So now you're using gravity to water everything, like the greenhouses and the hoop houses and stuff.
Yeah, and the benefit of that too is that all the water's warming up on the hill, so the plants
so you're not giving them
are
cold
smiling.
Water.
Yeah, they're a lot happier.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's great. So now it seems like CSAs are really taking off in the Valley. Do you see more room for growth there? Do you feel like that there's a market for it in Anchorage and in the Valley area?
I do, absolutely. And I would love to see more farmers providing, starting CSAs and providing CSAs. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, a CSA is a community-supported agriculture, and it's been around for since the 60s, I think, and there are thousands of CSAs, farms using this model all around the country now. And the idea with it is that your community around you supports the farmer who grows the food. So if you as the consumer would like, you know, believe in local food and value the importance and the nutrition of it, you can pay your local farmer a certain price for, and in exchange, get a box of food every week. And you're really helping that farmer out, because then they have money up front in the beginning of the season to purchase seeds, tools, equipment that they might need. And so there's a little less guesswork, say, than from just, you know, going to the market on Saturday and hoping you sell everything you have and not really knowing what you're going to do with it if you don't sell it all, sort of thing. So,
and also a lot of people, I think, want to be doing, I mean, not everybody can do what you're doing, because it's really, it's more than a full-time job what you're doing, running the place off the grid and growing food for yourself and growing for other people. But I know a lot of people would like to do a little bit to contribute to that. So yeah. One of the things people can do is contribute to somebody who's already doing that, and you can start out, you know, experience what it's like to buy vegetables from a local farmer who really cares about what they're doing and is trying to, because they're eating the food too. It's not being shipped across the country. Mm-hmm. So you have a vested interest in growing, you know, nourishing, healthy food. And then once people experience that, they go, I wonder if I could do that. And so there's like an exchange of information that can happen.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, it's sort of a, it can create a community movement.
It can. And, you know, it's really an amazing system. I love the CSA model, because it enables you to really create community within your community or within the people that have shares in your farm, and to get to know them better. And it's just a unique relationship that evolves between the customer and the farmer that doesn't exist in the grocery store, and doesn't really even exist in the relationships that you create at a market. And you know, a lot of CSAs will have folks come to the farm and work, you know, a day or a few days throughout the season, and so that they can see, like, oh, this is what it takes to grow this food and be part of that. So it's definitely a growing model all over the country, all over the valley, and there's a ton of room. We have a pretty big waiting list right now for our CSA, and we'd love to offer more in the future, but we also value quality over quantity, so we'll always be small.
Great. There's a way it connects people to their food, too. I've heard several people have told me stories about having a brother or a sister-in-law who's, like, afraid to eat something that doesn't come perfectly neat and packaged from the supermarket. Like, it's actually – there's a lot of fear around food in some ways. You know, people – like, there's some way in which the food appears sanitized in the supermarket, so it appears safe, you know, versus, like, going out in a field and picking a carrot and having to wash the dirt off of it and then eat it. You know, and it's so funny how you know, what we think of as healthy and what we think of as nourishing has been totally, it's like a 180 how we see food, and that, like, versus, like, what it's sort of, it, to me, it makes sense, like, you want to get, like, pull the thing out of the earth, you know, like, knock the dirt off and eat it. But most people, their idea of what food is and the way it should look has all been shaped by what they experience when they walk into a, you know, a big box store or a supermarket.
Yeah,
for sure. And I mean, we look at the CSAs as healthcare providers.
Absolutely.
It really is an investment in your health. And you can feel the difference. I mean, if you actually go into the store, and I really don't want to knock the stores too much, because in the winter months, it's, you know, it's not practical for everybody to have a root cellar. And, you know, I'm grateful that there's some greens available at Fred Meyer's and Carr's Safeway. But really, there's no comparison when you actually do get vegetables that are grown fresh in the valley here, and you're just enlivened, you're just totally invigorated after eating the vegetables, and it really is night and day.
Allie just brought over some of the first greens that she grew in her greenhouse, and we actually got to try them before doing the show. And what an experience of eating a fresh green that just came up. It's like it's just screaming spring. Yeah, and it very different than what you get in the soup. Even the stuff in the supermarket, the best organic that you can get, it's still been on a plane or it's been on a barge for a little bit of time.
Yeah, so the question I guess I'm wondering about is how far can we go with this to provide locally and really support the community? it seems like this is the future. And, you know, of course, Alaska is dependent on freight to feed this entire population, more or less. And so having a really robust community agricultural program seems like it makes a lot of sense. Is there a way to expand the growing season in a practical fashion, in a large scale, in the state of Alaska? And you know, can we take this further?
Yeah, I think absolutely. There's a way to extend the season. It's kind of a multifaceted answer, I guess, because one, I think that everyone can do something, right? You don't necessarily need to go out and buy some 5-acre farm and start growing large. I mean, that's great, and some people are going to do that, but you can be growing greens in your windowsill. You can, you know, plow a little plot in your backyard and be growing some carrots and kind of just take one step at a time. And I think the biggest thing that I like to emphasize is that I didn't really know a lot of these things before I just tried them myself, and everything's just trial and error and talking to people and being excited about learning and reading books. And I think that there's, you know, I look at people like Elliot Coleman, who is just here visiting, who runs Four Season Farm in Maine, and he has taught us a lot about the potential for extending the season in Alaska. And the state, the Division of Ag, has created this high tunnel program where they're trying to encourage farmers to put up high tunnels, and which will allow you to grow basically a glorified hoop house.
That's what I was going to say. A high tunnel is a hoop house?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. A large hoop house that you can walk in or have, you know, drive a tractor in, uh-huh, or something like that. And it's just taken off. A lot of people around the state are using those, and so people are able to grow earlier in the season and later in the season. And there's just a lot of experimentation that you know to be done in terms of what can be grown. I mean, there are a lot of greens that as long as you have them mature by the time, you know, the sun goes away or it starts freezing and you have them covered up, they can literally go dormant and then kind of thaw out in spring and be ready to eat.
Wow.
So there's a lot of stuff like that. And that was our goal with building our greenhouses. Let's see what we can really do with this. And
what was the most anything surprising that you were able to grow here that you didn't think that you could grow?
Well, ask me in another year and I'll let you know. I'm working on ginger is the next one.
Really?
And trying to think about the things that I miss in, you know, my diet that don't grow here. And honestly, there's not much, but ginger would be really nice. Mm-hmm. And I think that we should be able to grow that. We're going to focus more on mushrooms as well. And
we'd be doing
some hops, I think.
Hops. Okay. Will you be doing medicinal mushrooms, like Chinese mushrooms, or just like, you know, shiitake mushrooms?
Start with shiitake, maitake, mm-hmm, but I'd like to go more into medicinal, mm-hmm, for you know, also for making herbal medicine for different ailments, thyroid, joint pain, stuff like that.
Yeah, and we haven't even gotten there yet, but Allie knows a lot about traditional herbal medicine, so probably we'll talk about that in the second half of the program.
Yeah. How do you do with garlic?
Garlic does excellent up here, and I think that the key is to plant it in the fall. We've never had luck in the spring, so plant it in the fall. And I would recommend, you know, with anything, it really comes, the success of what you're doing comes down to the quality of what you're using. So, you know, if you have good seed garlic, which if you haven't planted that before, it's just the cloves, right? So you plunge your cloves in the ground, ideally at least 2 weeks before things freeze, and then mulch it heavily. And then in the spring, move that straw or whatever leaves away and let the shoots come up and then, you know, keep it well weeded, and come, you know, August, September, you'll be pulling bulbs. Every clove will, you know, will make a bulb, and then you have your seed for the next year. So garlic is awesome.
That sounds great. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about your medicinal work and also medicinal herbs and the things you're growing for medicine purposes. But I also want to hear more about the permanent Earthship style greenhouse. I want to hear about that. So we'll be back in just
a few
minutes.
Back.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, KVRF 89.5 on your FM dial. If you'd like to get involved with Radio Free Palmer, contact us at radiofreepalmer.org. This is your chance to invent community radio in Sutton, Butte, Chickaloon, and the surrounding areas. A portion of this broadcast is brought to you by KVRF members and the generosity of Silva Insurance Services, located in the heart of Palmer, Alaska. A locally owned, community-minded Palmer business since 2006, finding the right insurance for your home, your sled, your ATV, health insurance, business insurance, including employee benefits. Silva Insurance, a strong, committed community partner.
Thanks for joining us again on The Bridge to Everywhere. And we're on the second half of our show, and we've just been talking to Allie Barker, farmer extraordinaire, about CSAs, community-supported agriculture, and also about root cellars. And before we move on, I had a quick question for her about seeds. You know, for somebody who's just starting from scratch, you know, where do you go to get seeds? What's the source that you use?
Well, right now we mail order most of our seeds. We're pretty picky about where we get them in terms of kind of the policy of the farms and making sure they don't use genetically modified seed and things are, you know, organic and kind of know which farms they come from. So we really like Johnny Seeds and Peaceful Valley Farm Supply and Fedco and High Mowing. Those are all great. Oh, and Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa. They've got one of the largest seed saving banks in the world. However, something that more folks are starting to do here and that really is integral in our food security in Alaska, considering we import 95% of our food or 98% of our food and only have something like 4-day food supply if the barges don't come or the planes don't come in, which actually did happen, you know, at one point in time. And gosh, I can't remember. I want to say it was in like the 70s here, but some woman told me about it and she said, oh yeah, you know, within a day you couldn't even get a can of cat food on the shelf. And,
wow.
And so, I mean, it's good because you're hearing more and more people talk about this sort of thing. So, well, if that happens, you know, what are the chances you're going to be able to get all those seeds that you once got? So, I mean, there are a lot of things that you can save yourself in terms of seed saving. One thing that actually I tried this spring was forcing vegetables, which is something any of you could do, with biennials like carrots, kohlrabi, what else did I do? Beets. And, you know, cabbage, but I pulled a few of those out of the root cellar and then I stuck them in a bucket of soil and put them in a sunny window and in the greenhouse. And we've been eating beet greens and turnip greens and for, you know, a month now. And if I continued to let them grow and go to seed, well, then I can save those seeds and then I have that seed to be able to plant. So that's a good way to be able to save seed from biennials. Other things you can let go to seed, you know, and save your seed are, you know, lettuce and spinach and tomatoes and squash and pumpkins and your garlic and, of course, potatoes. So a lot of that stuff you can either probably find locally or find from other farmers or try to save yourself. And I know that there are my friends up at Calypso Farm in Fairbanks. They just started an acre seed saving garden. So that's their main goal, is let's try to save everything we can so that we have that, so that it's one less step in the dependency cycle, you know, of getting things from elsewhere.
How do seeds need to be stored?
Well, it depends on the seeds, but honestly, I can say I don't store them the most ideal way, because in a constant temperature would be ideal, but, you know, they're kept dry in the dark, in a cool spot, but they're in the cabin that is warm and cold and warm and cold and warm and cold.
So they're not in the root cellar, though.
They're not in the root cellar. Exactly. Just dry, cool, and dark.
And is there, for those of us who have very little experience with gardening, you know, where would you, is there a reference guide that you would start with? Is there a course that you would suggest, you know, something as like an extension course? Is there something where somebody who's just starting from zero, you know, who really doesn't know anything, how would you start the process, or a website on the internet? Like, where would you go first? Mm-hmm. If you just, because it seems like a lot of people, there's a lot of people in the community who know a lot.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, A, is there a place where, you know, like a Master Gardeners forum where mm-hmm. people are sharing all this information mm-hmm. and newbies can go and kind of soak up the information? Or is it, would you say like there's a book, this is like a must have if you're starting this process, what would you do?
Gosh, there are a lot of things. Actually, there is a Master Gardeners group in Anchorage. There's a permaculture group in Anchorage. There's Ellen Vanavis, who has Good Earth Garden School. I actually took an organic gardening course from her 12 years ago. And she's still doing it.
Yep.
And learned a lot from her. There's a wealth of knowledge in the community. I mean, it's amazing when you start meeting your neighbors, you realize that, wow, that guy is the best asparagus patch I've ever seen. Holy cow, I didn't even know you could grow asparagus like that. So
wait, you mean like talk to your neighbors?
Exactly. Talk to your neighbors.
Is there a course for doing how you actually do that?
Do you mean not on Facebook? Not email your neighbors, like stick your nose out the door and say, hey, how come you still have apples? Actually, that brings up two questions. So I want to talk a little bit about permaculture, what that is. But I also want to know if you have any tips for how to keep the moose out of your garden.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah, that's a big one for people. Yeah, fence. So it's really the only way to do it is an 8-foot fence.
And how
a tall fence.
Uh-huh.
In my opinion, well, we've got a 6-foot fence around everything. In my opinion, the energy and effort you put into growing food, you might as well put a fence around it, because you're gonna, you know, I can't even tell you how many people I know who have worked so hard, so many hours growing food the whole season, and then literally, you know, they say, hope tomorrow we're harvesting cabbages, and the moose hear it, and I kid you not, that night before they harvest, the moose come in and eat their cabbages. So it happens, and, you know, it's just that security. And I mean, not that they're not going to jump over the fence, but yeah, at least a 6-foot tall fence.
And is yours electrified?
Ours isn't, but mm-hmm. there are, you know, Spring Creek has, I think they did a 4-foot or 5-foot tall fence with electric fence on a little solar panel on the top. And whatever your system is, you know, you just got to make sure that it works. Because a lot of times with the electric fencing, there'll be a short or someone mm-hmm. won't realize it's not on.
Yeah,
and the moose
and
get
they
in
get and, through it and that's it.
But yeah. Arctic Organics has, you know, a nice fence and then some, you know, electric part on top. And everyone has a little different system. There are also those people like my mentors and I'm not sure what I'd call them, but inspiration for doing everything that we do, Gary and Annette Soderstrom up in Trapper Creek, and they have grown a lot of food for a long time, and they've never had a fence. So I think they just have some special relationship with the moose, where they say.
Well, Ellie Vandevice talks about that a little bit. Like she taught us to grow with sacrifice radishes.
Yeah.
put a perimeter of radishes around, and then the bugs eat the radishes, mm-hmm. and they so you know. Yeah. So I guess there's there, and she also what's her book is Ask.
Ask Mother Nature,
right? She has a whole chapter on talking to your garden pests and encouraging them to go elsewhere.
So
there are other, and I've heard people. One thing that I heard from someone last year was stringing plastic bags all the way around the garden, and supposedly the moose don't like that, the noise. But I haven't tried that yet. So
I think it's hard to get around not having a fence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we even have in different spots around our place, we've made like these tripods around Saskatoons and to just keep the moose from eating that. I mean, the other thing is don't get rid of all the moose habitat,
right?
Because then the moose have something to eat and then they will be happy if you take all that, you know, willow and the shrubbery and.
Right. And your garden looks much more tasty. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay. So anything that moose won't eat that you've found that are generally safe?
Potatoes. Seems like, yeah, we always have our potato patch outside of the garden area. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit, what is permaculture? You hear a lot of people talking about it. What is it?
Well, permaculture comes from permanent agriculture, and Bill Mollison was one of the fathers of permaculture, and he kind of traveled all over the world, really going to these dry, arid, desert places and creating systems for growing food and creating life that was symbiotic and worked together to create a permanent agriculture. So, for example, with permaculture, most of it is, well, as many perennials are used as possible versus annuals. So the idea is let's create a permanent zone for these plants to live so that they come back year after year, and you don't have to go through all that intensive planting of annuals every year. And the other thing is a lot of times in, you know, permaculture farms I've been to in Costa Rica and Mexico, and a lot of times you don't even know you're really at a farm because it's so integrated, and you'll have, a lot of plants will actually grow better and produce better if they're grown with other plants. So you might have an apple tree, and underneath it you've got, there's one thing called an apple guild in permaculture, and so under your apple tree you have these, say, six concentric circles, and in each circle you have a different crop or a different plant that benefits the other one, and they've all got a different job. You know, one keeps weeds out. One feeds nitrogen into the soil. One attracts beneficial insects. One, right, so they all do different things. And with the apple guild, you might use comfrey and clover and rhubarb and chives, you know, perennial chives and all these different things. And the idea is when you create this system, it does all the work, and it's less, you know, people having, you know, get in there and weed and tinker with this and with that. And the permaculture works on the zone system. So zone one is the things that you use every day, and those are going to be closest to your home, and then move outward to the things that you don't use every day.
It's interesting when you're talking about that, because I'm thinking about like how I traditionally grew up to think about what gardening was, and it was really like this. Well, I want this to look a particular way, and so we're gonna call these other things that are in here already that I don't like, weeds. So we're gonna you know, poison those things. you know, make the dandelions, make the red clover, make mm-hmm. the pineapple weed, make mm-hmm. the plantain, all that stuff go away, mm-hmm. and then we're gonna plant our, you know, whatever it is in that patch, or we're going to make something look a particular way, but we're not thinking about, we're thinking like superficially, we're thinking yeah. about aesthetics
yeah.
and we're doing all this crazy grafting stuff and creating a particular look mm-hmm. and that's sort of like, okay, wow, look at this beautiful thing I created, but it takes so much work versus like looking at how plants symbiotically work together. And mm-hmm. like you said, letting them do the work, mm-hmm. kind of like, Joel Salatin in The Omnivore's Dilemma, that where he talks about this is a farm where the animals do all the work. Mm-hmm. You're saying something similar.
He embraces
similar.
The chickenness of the chicken,
right?
And the pigness
right,
of the pig,
right?
And
right.
I
and,
love that.
Yeah, and I just like the idea of, you know, when I start thinking about things that just grow, you know, red clover or mm-hmm. or nettles or dandelion, all those things have so much nutrients mm-hmm. in them. So yeah. why try to discourage them from growing in your garden? Why not mm-hmm. you know, make it work with your garden?
Yeah, well, and a lot of those things grow in certain places for certain reasons, or they grow somewhere and they are telling you something about your soil mm-hmm. or and so at least creating a space where you can grow those things is useful. And you know, we actually grow red clover in all of our walkways to suppress, you know, quackgrass and other quote weeds from growing up. But what we can do with that is then we'll harvest all the red clover blossoms and dry them, and then use that for, you know, dry them in our sauna, and then use that for tea for the whole winter. I guess we'll do that with chickweed. We'll make chickweed tincture and chickweed pesto and that sort of thing.
And we had Stella on a little while ago, and she talked about chickweed. Chickweed's the weight loss herb of choice. chickweed is an amazing herb, and most people are just trying to, you know, pulling it out of their garden as fast as they possibly
yeah.
can.
And what is your recipe for chickweed pesto? I think we yeah, want to yeah. hear what that is.
I usually use chickweed, and so fresh chickweed and basil and olive oil and salt and then cheese optional, you know, and, mm-hmm. and basically blend it all together. And I really like keeping food in its really most primitive state possible for nutritional value. And so not cooking it and not even freezing it, just putting a layer of olive oil on top in the jar, and then putting it in the root cellar, and it preserves just fine. And then you can pull your chickweed nettle pesto out in the middle of winter and enjoy it.
And it'll hold for months.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Yeah. As long as it's amazing. I mean, you know, Native Alaskans really put away most of their food in seal oil. They had these large wooden vats and their fish and all their berries, and a lot of stuff was just in salt or seal oil and you know, yellow dock. They put away a lot of dock, the plant dock for
that's a big blood builder, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Really good for the liver. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Liver and heart, and anyone who drinks too much beer.
Great. Good to know. Excellent for the liver.
One thing I wanted to ask about is amending the soil. And any resources or recommendations for people to learn about that and maybe having their soil tested?
Yeah. The absolute best resources in the Valley are Christine and Bob Gregg, the Laskasee Ag. And they are just a wealth of knowledge on soil and soil science, and have the ability to kind of dumb down some of the complicated stuff so that the layperson can understand what they're saying. And I mean, you can read. I would encourage you to just anyone to pick up any organic gardening book, and you know, Ellen Vanavis is a good resource for that too, and really heavily focuses on compost. And we're fortunate in Alaska to have a lot of local resources to use for amendments for our soil, like fishbone meal and kelp, and really Alaska fishbone meal being fish being the main one. And you know, we always bring our fish heads and parts home from the river and compost them and make fish emulsion and, you know, can the rest for Dylan.
So you can compost fish parts.
Yeah. And, I mean, I know you have to be careful with that, with where you are and with bears, but we've literally put fish parts in our compost after we've had a nice big pile ready. We put them in there, and 3 days later, there's no sign that the fish has even gone in there. Well, so
yeah, your compost
really
piles
hot.
Are pretty impressive, though. You've got the most amazing compost. I mean, they're actually putting off heat. I mean, you're standing next to your compost piles, you get a suntan.
It would be nice to that
before, yeah.
Pale Alaskan complexion in the middle of winter.
Yeah. Yeah, and we were at Chris and Bob's house, and they showed us a video one time.
It's from Japan.
About it was a place in Japan where they had soil that had just been, you know, ravaged with pesticides and chemicals. And they looked at, and what they did in the video was they looked at, you know, the soil, and it just was dead. Mm-hmm. There was no life in it. You know, there were no microorganisms at all. And I think it took them 10 years to restore this, and I forget what the size of land it was, you know, how many number of acres it was, but they showed going through the process of what had to be done to restore the soil. But, you know,
it's lengthy. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, is that we are losing so much topsoil in this country, in Alaska, everywhere. I mean, the Mount Uska Valley is some of the best soil anywhere, and we need to preserve that because it takes a long time to build up your soil. And, you know, some things that we've adopted to do that are we use a broad fork, and which is a large tined, probably, what's that, 40, probably 2.5 feet, 3 feet wide, big fork that we stand on and kind of move forward and backwards. And that's what we do in every bed, every mm-hmm. year. And that's how we aerate the soil so that, we choose not to till in our older beds, so that in any bed that's not new first year, so that we can maintain those microbial communities, and mm-hmm. and then we add a lot of compost.
Well, so you're just kind of rocking back and forth and creating an
loosening
airflow,
it, exactly.
But you're not actually going and just like ripping everything apart.
Yeah, because you know, over and you can see, you know, in our beds, some beds that are 8+, you know, years old, you can see the absolute difference in how the water drains through there and the quality of, you know, carrots in an 8-year-old bed versus a new bed, and something that has had a lot of, you know, love and dedication and time and energy put into that soil.
And these are raised beds you're talking about?
Yeah. The original ones were more raised, and we've got a bunch of different, you know, as we've kind of evolved and figured things, mm-hmm. some things out over the years, they've changed.
Any solutions for slugs? What do you do with slugs?
Oh, jeez. Oh, I, 2 summers ago, we had a horrendous slug problem, and I went out and when I got to 100, I would stop for the night. I know my mom growing up put out little dishes of beer every night, and in the morning she'd pull the slugs in, and I had a friend who was running the farm at Knowles, and she put up these little like metal fences around so the slugs wouldn't crawl up and over, and had limestone screenings, and man, people try everything.
Diatomaceous earth.
Diatomaceous earth. Let's see. We actually had pretty good success. We made little cut out cardboard circles, like little rings, and put them around every brassica plant.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would collect on the bottom, and then we would pull them off. But, sprinkling diatomaceous earth
got any recipes for slugs?
Well, you know, I mean, there are.
If we're going to live with the slugs, we might as well eat them.
Well, my mom, right, she does this biodynamic method where she blends the slugs up, like in a blender, and then feeds them back to the plant. Mm-hmm. And that is, that's one way that some people have dealt with them. And ask Mother Nature, Ellen Vanovich, she would, you know, talking to the slug devas. And I think there are a lot of different methods, and man, I would just try everything you can, because they can devastate your crop.
Just speaking with a friend recently, and she said she uses crumpled up eggshells.
Oh, yeah.
Is that effective?
Yeah, actually, we did that a lot. I did sprinkle broken up eggshells around the base of each plant. And the other thing was ducks, get some ducks. We had a group of traveling ducks we just passed around from farm to farm one year. And we harvested stuff from the garden, and then we put the ducks in there. And they are just hilarious. And they'll root around with their beaks, and they'll eat slugs
and
slug eggs.
And they'll eat the slugs
eggs.
And leave the greens.
Well, no, you kind of want to put them in there when you don't care about what other stuff that's in there at the end of the season. Or maybe your slug problem's so bad that it's just worth having them in there. Mm-hmm. But they do a pretty good job.
So you want to talk a little bit about the
Earthship.
The Earthship.
Oh, yeah. I had this. I was actually inspired by Anna Edie, who wrote this book called Solviva. That should be on the list.
Okay.
And I studied with her in college, and she is just this extraordinary, intelligent, creative woman who said, I'm going to grow food year-round in Massachusetts without heat. And she built this greenhouse, this solar greenhouse. And in the back, she had animals, chickens and rabbits, and a water wall. So, water is an amazing collector of heat for mass. So maybe you have some sort of mass wall. Maybe it's rock. Maybe it's people have used rock. Actually, a farm up in North Pole has done that successfully to retain heat, gain heat through the day and let the heat off it at night to keep things warm. She did a water wall anyway between her animals and the water wall, and just the sun. She grew food year-round in this greenhouse. And well, I've dreamt of building a greenhouse like that for a long time, and through getting this Alaska Agriculture Innovative Grant, the Division of Ag, was kind of help me to create this. Jed was said, okay, let's do it. And it was a massive undertaking. I don't think I had any idea what we were getting into. But I wanted to build it in the hill. So we dug out a big hole, kind of the opposite. Actually, it looks at our root cellar. So we dug a huge hole. This thing's about 16 by 40.
This thing faces south then?
It faces south. And the whole north side is buried into the hill, and then it's got about 69 degree south face of windows, and then a 3 foot clerestory section of all opening windows, and then a roof line that heads back to the north. And we have a mass wall in the north side. And right now we've got a bunch of starts and plants growing in there. And we're just about to mill a bunch more wood and build all the beds and get stuff growing in the ground in there this year. And a lot of our heat, we have to do some things differently up here than in Massachusetts and Maine, especially with our low light. So we have a wood stove that will have a copper coil wrapped around it, and then similar to putting radiant floor heat in your house, we're doing that underneath our beds. So the PEX pipe will go under all the beds and then through all the water barrels on the north side and circulate without a pump by setting it up properly, and then keep things warm, extend our season on the front end and the back end. And our inspiration again, Gary and Annette Soderstrom in Trapper Creek, they did this in their greenhouse, and they are just throwing the cucumbers out the window, giving them away. Yeah, they're huge. They've got so much food they don't know what to do with.
That's exciting.
It's their little secret.
Do you have any thoughts about hydroponic growing?
Not a hydroponic expert, can't say. Just I have this connection with the soil, so I don't quite understand soilless growing.
That seems so. I mean, I went in to check out the local hydroponic store, but it seems like I thought it would be a great thing for here, but it seems like a lot of chemicals that there were. The bottles look really, happy and friendly with lots of colors on them, but ultimately it's just a lot of chemicals that the plants are sitting in rather than actual soil, which is different.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of incentive, a lot of inputs that need to be brought in for the system to work. Yeah. So perhaps talking to a more experienced hydroponic grower.
Yeah, to learn more, sure.
And are you have you already hired interns for this year? Do you already have people set up to work for you for the whole year?
Yeah, hey, if you're out there listening, you want to come work with us.
Can people come and work for a week or, you know, or a day or what?
We've got two folks right now who are coming this year, a guy who'll be here for 6 weeks and then another woman July through October. And yeah, folks are, we've got a woman from Anchorage coming one day a week, and different people are coming to, are interested in different aspects of what we're doing, from milling wood to putting up food to fermenting food to canning fish to, you know, butchering a moose to, you know, growing food to the marketing and CSA aspect of farming, so all sorts of different things. But we've got a little write-up on our website at chugachfarm.com if you want to check it out. Or we're always psyched to learn from other people and create that network.
Now, where are you located for the Saturday markets?
We are at the Spinard Farmers Market in Anchorage under the big windmill in Chilkoot Charlie's parking lot every Saturday from 9 to 2.
Great. Well, we'll have some information we'll share on our Facebook page where people can learn more and connect with your website and maybe some of the books you mentioned as well.
Yeah, we just want to thank you very much for joining us this evening on The Bridge to Everywhere. And yes, we will be adding resources up on the Facebook page as well.
And our next show will have Dr. Amy Chadwick, naturopathic doctor, and we're going to talk about gluten and living a gluten-free lifestyle. I hope you can join us for that.
Thanks, everyone,
really
for joining us tonight.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Allie.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links, and resources from our guests and show topics.
KVRF Sutton, Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 on your FM dial, Big Cabbage Radio.